Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my site softer?
Can I make my site firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side, your Sleep Number setting. Enjoy personalized comfort for better sleep night after night. And now, during our President's Day sale, take 50% off our limited edition bed, plus an extra $100 off all mattresses. End Saturday. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. It is Monday after Super Bowl, and I am back. Here is my wife, the host of this podcast, Kelly Evans. Take it away, Kelly.
Okay. So welcome back to Mama Mystery. Like he said, I am your host, Kelly. And yeah, we have a special episode for you today that includes Austin. I know some of you are really excited to have him back. Some of you may not be, and that's fine. Austin, you have to say something.
I don't know why anyone would not be happy to see me here. Anyways, we had a weekend, a rough weekend. It began with me taking Kelly on a date Friday night. We went to eat, and on the way home, I didn't feel good. We got home. Kelly had been puking. Kennedy had been puking. Then Kelly put all of our kids to bed, and then I went to sleep on the couch. Jack came down because he was puking. Him and Kennedy puked all night. I never did, thank God, but I didn't sleep all night. Woke up Saturday night. What am I talking about? Woke up Saturday morning to Ellie covered in puke. Then Kelly started puking all day. And sickness just wrecked our house. And I held things down all day Saturday until I got all the kids to bed. And I was like, hallelujah, an hour of silence. And then Augie hollers downstairs, "Hey, Daddy, I just puked in my sheets."
The picture of him puking, standing next to his bed. I mean, it literally looked like, you know, that scene in The Office when Kevin dumps his pot of chili on the floor. It was like that in the middle of Augie's bed. It was so, so gross.
And then he got sick every 30 minutes until 5:20 a.m. And that was our weekend.
Yeah, it was awful. I was quarantined to our bedroom all day Saturday, and I'm so grateful Austin felt a little bit better so that he was able to hold it down, because I was the sickest I've been in years. I lost count of how many times I got sick. I mean, it was just the worst. But then Sunday, it got a little better. I mean, I think we were all sort of feeling like we were in recovery mode, and we had the Super Bowl, which was like pretty underwhelming. I don't know about you.
Yeah, the first three quarters, there was no touchdown, so it was just boring as hell. And then everybody on the internet wants to talk about how political the halftime show was, which I don't really get. I didn't watch it, but I really don't get it, and I really don't care. And people were like, "If you aren't posting about the halftime show, then I know everything I need to know about you." And I'm like, I don't even know what that means.
Yeah. Okay. So yes, everyone was politicizing the halftime show prior to it, you know, happening, I guess, on Sunday, because they all knew that it was going to be mostly in Spanish, and everyone's like, "This is America and you should only speak English." And so I watched the halftime show. I watched it this morning on YouTube, and I'm sure that being there was a different experience. I feel like every time there's a Super Bowl halftime show, you get the perspective of people in the stands, and it's actually so underwhelming compared to what the actual video looks like on TV. But so you know, you have that, but I watched the like TV version of it, and I was like bobbing my head and dancing. I liked it. I thought it was fun. I don't think you have to understand the language to understand the artistry and the creativity and the culture and like rhythm of it all. And I just think of anyone who, you know, wants to turn this into a negative thing or bitch and moan about it, you're basically like Angela Martin on The Office who refuses to dance at Cafe Disco. That's kind of how I see you. Like, you just don't like fun, you're allergic to fun, and you like to bitch and moan just to hear yourself bitch and moan. So that's kind of my take on it. And that's coming from someone who is typically kind of conservative, but I just follow my own opinions. I don't follow everyone else's. But that's kind of how I felt about it. I enjoyed it.
You're heavy on The Office references today. I think that everybody made it political because that's what people like to do. But the reality is the NFL has been expanding their reach to like the international level for a couple of years now, playing international games in Brazil and whatnot. And then in 2025, you know, I didn't even really know much about Bad Bunny. I know like one of his songs. I don't really, I'm not like a fan. I just don't care. But he had over almost 20 billion streams in 2025. So I know that his global popularity was huge. So I think that more than anything, it was a commerce move. They were just trying to capitalize and grow their international footprint. And we live in 2026 in America. So everybody was like, let's make it political. Hell yeah.
And like, if you choose to get involved in all of this kind of stuff, I think you have to perpetually live in a state of pissed off. And I just think that doesn't sound like fun. So I would rather just dance to some Bad Bunny, even if I don't know who he is. It's good music. You know, I like Kendrick Lamar and I don't understand half his lyrics, but I don't understand a lot of English speaking rappers because they rap. I mean, it's kind of hard to understand sometimes, but I still love their music. And that just makes me sound probably like an idiot. But anyway, that's kind of how I felt about the whole halftime show. I can't wait for all this stuff to settle down and we can just be pissed off about the next thing. All right. So now that we've got all that chatter out of the way, let's get into today's actual story, what you guys all are here for. This is a really deeply unsettling story. Austin, I don't even think you could be prepared for this. There's no way
I'm
to prepare yourself
for any of these, to be honest.
You never are, which is what makes it so interesting to have you on here. On a warm June night in 1992, an 18-year-old girl named Katie Ratcliffe left a nightclub and started her walk home. It was a route that she knew well, one that she had taken before, but this time she never made it home. By morning, Katie's body was discovered miles away near a cemetery. She had been stabbed over and over again in an attack that was so violent, so excessive, that investigators immediately believed they were looking for a sadistic offender, somebody who was dangerous, someone experienced, and someone capable of extreme brutality. What police were actually dealing with, though, was something far more unsettling. This is the case of the murder of Katie Ratcliffe. Katie Ratcliffe was an 18-year-old girl living an ordinary and hopeful life. She grew up in Kimberley, Nottinghamshire, in a close-knit family home with her parents, Helen and Joe.
What is Nottinghamshire?
Nottinghamshire is like in the UK. We're across the pond in this episode.
Man, I bet people over there would listen to this and be like, you are an idiot. That'd be like somebody saying, they're from Missouri, and somebody over there being like, what is that? It's a place.
That's really insightful commentary. Thank you so much. By all accounts, she was deeply loved and well cared for. Friends and family described her as bright, bubbly, and kind, the kind of person who made connections very easily and was genuinely interested in the people around her, which made her a great fit for cosmetology. She was training as an apprentice hairdresser, something that she took seriously and felt excited about. And hairdressing was not just a temporary job for Katie. It was a skill that she was building towards a future. And she talked openly about her goals of wanting to get married someday, have children, and eventually open up a salon of her own. So she had plans and she had imagined a full life ahead of her. Katie's parents described her as a very happy girl, but also one who was perhaps a little too trusting. They worried about her openness, about how easily she assumed the best in people. They would caution her to be more careful, to be more guarded, and Katie would brush it off, telling them they worried too much. In the weeks leading up to her ultimate death, Katie had gone through a breakup with her boyfriend. She was heartbroken and she had tried to reconcile only to be turned away. Now, not much is known about her boyfriend, how long they were together, or why they broke up, but we do know that Katie took the breakup pretty hard. Like a lot of 18-year-olds experiencing that kind of disappointment for the first time, she was really hurting, but she was still trying to move forward. So on the evening of June 6th, 1992, Katie decided to go out with some of her friends to the Ragamuffin's nightclub. Her friends thought that they could try to cheer her up, and Katie went along with it, trying to distract herself, to feel normal again, to enjoy a night out with her friends. She danced, she laughed, and at some time around 2:30 in the morning, Katie left the club alone and started walking home. Now, that detail would later stand out, the fact that she left alone, but at the time, it wasn't alarming. Katie lived locally. The walk home was familiar. It was late, but not unheard of for her to walk home before, like alone. And there is no evidence that she left with anyone, no indication that she was coerced, persuaded, or followed out of the club by someone she knew. There was no witnesses that ever came forward to say that they saw her arguing with anyone or getting into a vehicle. And after Katie walked out of Ragamuffin's, she effectively vanished. There were no confirmed sightings after that point. No phone calls, no interactions, just a gap, and one that would remain unanswered for hours. By the time the sun came up, whatever had happened to Katie was already over. And the walk that she had made so many times before would become the last known moment anyone could place her alive. Just after sunrise on the morning of June 7th, 1992, a group of boys who were camping overnight near a cemetery in Farnboro were packing up their gear when they stumbled across something horrific. At first, it wasn't immediately clear what they were looking at, but as they moved closer, it became obvious that a young woman's body had been left there, partially undressed and badly injured. Emergency services were called and police quickly arrived on the scene. The body was that of Katie Ratcliffe, and she was pronounced dead at the scene. Go ahead.
Can you imagine those kids? Like, I try to think of this stuff when I hear it. I don't think of it like all the true crime people where it's like, I don't know. I think of it differently, probably just as like an innocent bystander who doesn't really know much about this. But I think about being that pack of friends that found her, that pack of kids that found her, like that would haunt you forever.
For sure. And I think often we talk about cases where a body was discovered by an innocent bystander or passerby, and we probably discredit often what kind of impact that would have on an innocent person just stumbling across a crime scene and how like the PTSD that would come with that. So the location of Katie's body immediately raised questions. Farnboro was more than 4 miles from Ragamuffin's nightclub, and it was nowhere near Katie's home. So this was not a place that she would have ended up by accident, and it wasn't anywhere that she would have walked to willingly in the early morning hours. What investigators found at the scene was deeply disturbing. Katie had been stabbed repeatedly. Estimates range from 27 to more than 30 times, with a knife believed to have had a blade around 6 inches long. And some of the wounds were so forceful that they passed straight through her body. So this was not a single moment of violence. It was sustained, it was frenzied, and excessive. There were no signs of a traditional sexual assault, but Katie's clothing had been disturbed and her genital area had been mutilated. Pathologists would later determine that some of those injuries were inflicted while she was still alive. To detectives, the message was clear. This was not a robbery. This was not a fight that spiraled out of control. This was a deliberate and targeted act of extreme violence. So based on the brutality alone, police immediately began building a profile of the killer. They believed they were looking for an adult male, someone physically capable of overpowering an 18-year-old woman, transporting her body several miles, and inflicting that level of violence. Someone with sadistic tendencies, someone who was obviously inherently dangerous. Early comparisons were made to historic sexually motivated killers. So the nature of the wounds, the overkill, and the mutilation suggested domination and control rather than impulse. As officers secured the scene and the investigation began, one thing was already painfully clear. Whoever did this had not acted on opportunity alone. They had acted with intent. So when investigators returned to the Ragamuffin's nightclub, they began interviewing staff, patrons, and anyone who had been there that night. They focused on reconstructing Katie's movements in the hours leading up to her disappearance, who she'd been seen with, who she'd spoken to, and whether anyone had noticed her leaving with another person. Friends who had been out with Katie that evening were questioned at length. They described a normal night. Katie had been social, relaxed, and engaged. She hadn't mentioned plans to meet anyone later. She had not argued with anyone. There was literally no recollection of seeing her leave with a man or getting her into a vehicle. Like, it was just a mystery. So police interviewed Katie's ex-boyfriend, as is standard in cases involving young women who are murdered. And he was cooperative. He provided an alibi and was quickly ruled out. There was no evidence tying him to Katie's movements that night, and no indication that he posed a threat to her. From there, investigators widened their scope. They canvassed the area around the club and along potential walking routes, and they appealed to the public for information as well. They looked for witnesses who might have seen a struggle or a vehicle that was pulled over or a woman matching Katie's description, but nothing came in. What made the case particularly frustrating was the absence of clear forensic direction. Katie had not been killed at the location where her body was found, which meant that the crime scene itself offered limited clues about the initial attack, and whatever vehicle had been used to transport her body left no obvious trace that could be immediately identified. And because of the nature of the injuries, police were operating under a very specific assumption. They believed Katie's killer was an adult male, likely someone older, physically strong, and sexually motivated. The mutilation suggested sadism, not like a frenzied panic. And the fact that Katie had been moved pointed towards access to a car and a willingness to take risks. So in short, investigators had developed this profile and they were essentially looking for a monster. But that profile shaped everything that followed. They focused on known violent offenders, adult men with criminal histories, men who fit the physical and psychological expectations of a sexually sadistic killer. At no point did anyone consider the possibility of another profile. So as weeks turned into months, the case stalled. Leads dried up, witness memories faded, and without a suspect who fit the profile police believed in, the investigation slowly lost momentum. Now, that's not to say they didn't have some moments of hope. Three suspects actually emerged, or should I say, people of interest, but ultimately they all led to nothing. One was considered the permed hair person of interest, and this man was the focal point of the investigation for years. Witnesses at Ragamuffin's nightclub reported seeing Katie with a man who had quote-unquote fashionable dark permed hair shortly before she vanished. Police believed he was the last person to see her alive. However, he was eventually cleared when no physical evidence linked him to the scene and witnesses' memories of the timing could not be solidified. Then there was a guy named Nick. Police released a specific sketch of a man only known as Nick, and he was a frequent attendee at the nightclub, and he was seen in the vicinity of the club and the potential abduction site that night. But despite a massive public appeal and the distribution of his sketch, he was never definitively linked to the crime and was eventually discounted as a person of interest who just happened to be in the area. So coincidence, bad timing, wrong place, wrong time.
So they investigated him and then just let it go.
Yes. And they did it with all three people because the next one was the driver of a bloodstained XR3. Detectives desperately sought the driver of a gray Ford Escort XR3. This person of interest was placed on the radar after reports surfaced of a man in a similar car who appeared to have bloodstains on his clothing on the morning of the murder. However, the vehicle was never found, and the report could not be substantiated with forensic evidence, which led police to believe that it may have been a mistaken sighting or just an unrelated incident.
How did they get onto him?
Well, because people apparently spotted him or came to the police with tips saying that they saw this guy driving this car who appeared to have bloodstains on his clothes in the area. But it just never came to fruition. Nothing ever came of it.
So random, or is it just me?
It does seem random. I mean, and I think people, when they come forward as witnesses, you know, in multiple cases, many cases, when the police are asking the public for tips, they probably get inundated with people even sharing the most mundane information in hopes that it might lead to something. So even if somebody saw somebody walking around with like dried mud, M-U-D, not blood, but mud on their pants, it could look like blood stains, you know, once it's all dried, and or even wet mud stains or oil stains. You know, somebody might just be mistaking stains for blood stains, and then they go to the police and say, you know, oh my gosh, I think I saw this guy in the area where you guys have been searching, and
just trying
it's
to help.
Really nothing. Yeah, exactly. So by the end of 1992, the murder of Katie Ratcliffe had gone cold. And while Katie Ratcliffe's murder investigation stalled, life in Old Dean continued. And during that same period, while detectives searched for her killer, a very different kind of danger was escalating quietly right under everyone's nose.
Every January, I tell myself the same thing. This is the year I'm going to feel better, more energy, clearer focus, just less dragging myself through every day. And I'll be honest, I usually start the year doing everything right, or at least I think I am. Like I'm sleeping, I'm eating better, I'm moving my body, and somehow I still feel exhausted and foggy and irritable over things that normally should not get to me, like even just my kids being kids. Well, for a long time, I just assumed that that was stress or burnout or just life in general. And what I didn't realize is that low iron can show up really quietly. Things like persistent fatigue, brain fog, headaches that don't go fully away, brittle nails, hair breakage, stuff that's easy to brush off or normalize. These are all symptoms that I was dealing with because I was suffering from low iron. And here's the thing, iron deficiency can exist even before anemia actually develops. So you can feel off long before anything looks serious or shows up like on a blood panel. So that is why I started looking into Siderol from PharmaNutra. Siderol is a premium iron supplement powered by patented sucrosomial technology. So basically the iron is protected so your body can absorb it more efficiently, about 3 to 4 times better than standard iron. And without the common stomach issues that people associate with iron supplements like nausea or constipation. It's made with just 2 main ingredients. There's 30 milligrams of sucrosomial iron and vitamin C, and it's a simple once a day capsule that you can take anytime with or without food. So what stood out to me is that it's backed by over 20 years of research and more than 150 clinical studies, and it's already trusted by over 2 million people worldwide. So if you're starting the year feeling kind of tired or foggy despite having these otherwise good habits, you're not alone, and this might be the support that your body needs. So do yourself a favor and head to PharmaNutra-US.com and use the code MAMA, that's M-A-M-A, for 10% off your first order of Siderol. That's PharmaNutra-US.com with the promo code MAMA. Feeling off doesn't always mean something's wrong. Sometimes it just means something is missing. So check it out today.
Sharon Louise Carr was 12 years old when Katie was killed. She was born in Belize in 1979 and grew up as one of 4 children in extreme poverty. She never knew her father, and after moving to the UK in 1986, when she was about 7 years old, her family's life was marked by a lot of domestic abuse. In one particularly brutal instance, Sharon's mother poured a pot of either boiling fat or boiling water over her stepfather, so like over Sharon's stepfather, her mom's husband, during an argument, which resulted in his hospitalization with severe burns and her mother being charged with assault. They ended up divorcing soon after, and her mom reportedly became even more unstable, just prioritizing alcohol and men over her children. Now, some reports indicate that Sharon's mother also engaged in voodoo rituals that involved the slaughter of neighborhood animals, including decapitating a neighbor's cat. Sharon would participate in this, and in a few incidents reported to authorities, she was accused of using a garden spade to behead a neighbor's dog. She also fried. Yeah. She also reportedly fried a live hamster in a pan, and she became known in the neighborhood to snatch cats and dogs, often returning them mutilated or not at all.
That's so strange and unfortunate. and weird that people like that exist. What are you getting out of that?
I don't know. I think, you know, everyone always says that there are signs, you know, when you talk about serial killers or just evil people in general, there are signs. And mutilating or harming animals as a child, that's a sign. Now, Sharon was a student at Cornwallis Junior School, and initially teachers described her as a polite girl and a helpful girl, but her behavior took a sudden sharp turn towards aggression and attention-seeking defiance. She would stare down her teachers for minutes at a time without blinking in a successful attempt at unsettling them. At just 10 years old, her behavior became so disruptive that her head teacher contacted social services in 1990. She was briefly placed in foster care, but was returned to her mother's house after about 1 month. And this time in foster care only worsened her mental health. And after she returned home, her mother stopped monitoring her as closely, which isn't saying a lot. I don't think she was monitored that well to begin with. Now, in her free time, she drew pictures of death and murder, filling notebooks with disturbing declarations like, "I am a killer, killing is my business, and business is good." This is a 10 to 12 year old girl writing things like this. And so it didn't take long for Sharon to become well known to the people in her community as a problem. A volatile, intimidating child who seemed to move through the neighborhood without fear, without supervision, and without any boundaries. Neighbors later said they were afraid of her. Sharon was often seen wandering the streets late at night, sometimes alone, sometimes with older kids, usually older boys. She carried a satchel that people believed contained knives or other weapons. She smoked weed with these kids, she drank, she bragged about violence, and she told anyone who would listen that she liked to hurt animals, not in passing and not with shame, but with pride. So obviously, when cats would go missing and dogs were found dead, in some cases mutilated, people suspected Sharon, but suspicion never turned into confrontation. Adults were uneasy, challenging a child who showed no fear and whose behavior felt unpredictable. And when concerns were raised with Sharon's mother, the mother just dismissed them outright, accusing neighbors of lying or just targeting her daughter unfairly. At school, Sharon's behavior had also deteriorated rapidly. What had once been described as charm turned into aggression. Teachers reported violent outbursts, verbal abuse, and an explosive temper. So she was excluded from school multiple times, and then social services were contacted repeatedly, but meaningful intervention just never stuck. She drifted
between...
I think
she ever sounds like she was charming.
I mean, that's a good point.
Did you say it went from charm to this?
Yeah, I mean, her teachers reported that at first she was charming, and some of her pictures, like, she looks like a sweet girl.
This is the same girl that we were just talking about killing as her business and stuff.
Yes, but the presentation that she gave to her teachers was very different until she, you know, started to crack and let her real self show.
It feels like super bad when the lunchbox full of dick drawings pops out and like that's what's really going on in the guy's head. So this girl was charming, but then she had all these, you know, persona of killing.
Yeah, she had a murderous tendency about her, I guess, like just a very, very dark side. So Sharon drifted between her mother's home, foster placements, and friends' houses, and there was no stability, no consistent supervision, and no one who seemed able or willing to control her behavior. So 2 years after Katie Ratcliffe was murdered, Sharon Louise Carr's violence finally crossed a line that could no longer be explained away as just acting out or seeking attention. On June 7th of 1994, exactly 2 years to the day after Katie's body was discovered, Sharon was now 14 years old and still attending school in Camberley. That morning, during a break between classes, Sharon approached another student, 13-year-old Anne-Marie Clifford. The two girls were not friends. They weren't in the same age group or class. They didn't socialize together. They simply attended the same school. So it was a very vague familiarity. Now, Sharon told Anne-Marie that she had lost some money in the school bathroom and asked her for some help finding it, and Anne-Marie agreed. So in the bathroom, Anne-Marie immediately spotted a coin on the floor. It was like in the corner of a bathroom stall. So she bends down to pick it up, and at that point, Sharon pulls out a knife and plunges it into her back. The blade was roughly 4 inches long. It punctured Anne-Marie's lung and just narrowly missed her heart. Students entered the bathroom moments later. The bell had rung and the halls were filling up, and Sharon had fled the scene. But Anne-Marie was found sitting on a toilet, unable to speak and covered in blood. Thankfully, she survived. Now, the randomness of the attack stunned everyone. Sharon had not lashed out in anger during an argument. She hadn't been provoked. She hadn't targeted someone she knew or disliked. And Anne-Marie recalled that Sharon was smiling and appeared happy during the assault.
A psychopath.
Yes. She had lured a near stranger into a confined space and then stabbed her from behind. After the attack, Sharon did not hide. She returned to school grounds and was seen talking casually with other students near the gates of the school. And when police arrested her, she did not deny what she had done. She told officers she always carried a knife for protection, claiming she was afraid of walking home alone in the dark. But this explanation didn't line up with what people already knew about her. Sharon regularly snuck out of her house at night. She ran the streets with older boys. She was not afraid of being alone in the dark. She was comfortable in it. So when questioned further, Sharon went even further. She openly admitted to stabbing animals. She spoke about it without shame. She told police that she actually enjoyed it. At 14 years old, Sharon Carr was taken into custody. She was sent to a young offenders institution, and it didn't take long for her to spill the details about all of her criminal activity to a prison officer. At first, authorities believed that Sharon's attack on Anne-Marie Clifford was the peak of her violence, but they were so wrong. While in custody, Sharon began talking eagerly. She formed an attachment to a female prison officer and over time began confiding in her. What started out as casual conversation quickly turned darker. Sharon spoke openly about her hurting animals, about enjoying violence, about the power she felt when someone was afraid of her. And then almost casually, she mentioned something else. She told the officer she had killed a girl before. Not recently, not accidentally, but years earlier. Sharon said she was responsible for the murder of Katie Ratcliffe.
Got the goosebumps.
At first, the confession was not taken seriously. Katie's murder had been unsolved for nearly 2 years, and investigators had been firmly convinced that the killer was an adult man. A 12-year-old girl did not fit the profile in any way, not physically, psychologically, or statistically. Officers assumed Sharon was either fantasizing, seeking attention, or attempting to inflate her reputation inside the institution. But Sharon did not just claim responsibility. She described the murder. She talked about stabbing Katie repeatedly, about how it made her feel, about the excitement, the control, the rush. She smiled as she spoke. And then she said something that made the officer stop listening as a skeptic and start listening as a witness. Because Sharon mentioned details about the crime that had never been released to the public. That information was passed to detectives. And when police finally interviewed Sharon, they expected some inconsistencies, exaggeration, maybe some secondhand knowledge. But what they got instead, Sharon was calm, flat and emotionless. She did not cry. She did not minimize. She did not express any kind of fear. Detectives would later say what stood out most wasn't what she said. It was how she said it. There was no hesitation, no guilt, just a chilling sense of ownership. As part of the investigation, Sharon's cell was searched, and what police found in her cell changed everything. They discovered her diaries. Not one, but multiple notebooks written both before and after her incarceration. page after page filled with violent fantasies, declarations of identity, and explicit references to Katie Ratcliffe. She did not just write about the murder, she relived it. So here are some excerpts from her diaries, okay? These are all exact quotes from her diaries. The first one is, "Remember KR, obviously Katie Ratcliffe. Oh God, did she get me going? So hot. Pity, really. I think about it and my head is spinning, but against the cops, I'm winning. This year, must tell about KR. Thought about KR a lot today. Soon I will trust someone to tell them what happened. Oh damn, I've got a taste for red rum and God, I want to get drunk. I swear I was born to be a murderer. Killing for me is a mass turn-on, and it just makes me so high. I never want to come down. I wish I could kill you again. I promise I won't make you suffer more, you slag. Your terrified screams turn me on. Did she deserve death or not? Maybe not, but it's too late now. I believe in pain as the mirror of the extreme perfection of man's ability, the resurrection of the animal, the supreme animal. That's why she had to be killed. I bet she's all bone and maggots by now. She shouldn't have tested me. Death by knife wounds and sex go together. They both take you, and all women should be taken. 12 years old.
These are so creepy and sadistic, and she's like mocking everything about it. This is crazy. How do people like this exist?
I don't know. In regards to the actual murder itself, she wrote in detail things like, I bring the knife into her chest. Her eyes are closing. She is pleading with me. So I bring the knife to her again and again. I don't want to hurt her, but I need to do violence to her. I need to overcome her beauty, her serenity, her security. There I see her face when she died. I know she feels her life being slowly drawn from her, and I hear her gasp.
Oh my God, this is so evil to even read. This is a little girl.
Yes, Austin.
And how old is this girl when she's doing this? How old is the girl killing?
12 years old.
So there's a 12-year-old killing an 18-year-old.
Correct. And then she wrote, Austin, she wrote, I guess she was trying to breathe. The air stops in the back of her throat. I am joyful. I enjoyed putting the blade up her. It made me feel powerful. End quote. 12 years old.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what your age, but that just makes it even more mind-blowing. Okay, and I don't know if I wasn't listening or if you said this, so I'm sorry, I'm just gonna be real. How did she know Katie?
She didn't.
This is just completely random.
Yes.
What was she doing out in the middle of the night? Are you going to get into all that?
Yes, I'll get into all of that. So at first, detectives treated Sharon Carr's confession with caution because they had seen false confessions before. They had seen attention-seeking behavior. They had seen troubled young offenders attach themselves to notorious crimes as a way to feel important or big, I guess. And on paper, Sharon still did not make sense. She had been 12 years old at the time of the murder. She was female. She was small. A child. Nothing about her fit the profile investigators had built for nearly 2 years. So police did what they do in moments like this. They tested her. Detectives began asking Sharon open-ended questions instead of leading ones. And they just let her talk. And she spoke. And Sharon was not guessing. She described the murder with confidence and specificity. She knew how many times Katie had been stabbed. She knew the type of weapon used. She described the positioning of Katie's body. She talked about the injuries in a way that matched the post-mortem findings, including details that had never been released to the public. And then at one point, Sharon mentioned an item that made investigators stop the interview. She told them she had taken Katie's bracelet. Katie was known to always wear a particular bracelet, and when her body was found, that bracelet was missing. And that detail had never been made public. It was only known to police and Katie's family. And Sharon did not hesitate when she mentioned it. She also described the genital mutilation, not in vague terms, but with a level of accuracy that aligned with what pathologists had documented and intentionally kept out of the media. That was the moment detectives realized they were not dealing with a fantasist. They were dealing with the person who had been there. Now, Sharon did give multiple versions of events. In some accounts, she claimed that she had been with two boys that night. In others, she placed herself alone with Katie. Sometimes she said the attack happened in a car. Other times she said it happened outside. But here's what never changed. She never denied stabbing Katie. She never denied enjoying it, and she never denied wanting to do it again. And despite the inconsistencies in her narrative, which investigators believed were just attempts to either exaggerate or control the story, the core knowledge remained consistent and verifiable. So detectives later said that while Sharon's versions of how things happened shifted, her understanding of what happened never did. She knew things only the killer would know. And by the time interviews ended, police were no longer asking whether Sharon Carr was involved. They were just asking how the fuck did a child do this and whether she had done it alone. Now, it's important to note, while Sharon Carr was eventually unanimously convicted of murder, the full truth of the night remains partially obscured by her conflicting confessions and the absence of forensic evidence. In two versions of the story, Sharon claimed she was in a car with two older teenage boys who offered an intoxicated Katie a ride home. Another version suggested she simply spotted Katie walking alone and attacked her in an alleyway out of jealousy and out of a desire to show off to her friends. But the thing is, police have never confirmed how Katie's body was moved from Camberley to Farnborough, which is like a 3 to 4 mile distance. Sharon did name two boys as helpers, but both of them were cleared by their alibis. So detectives remained certain that she had not acted alone, but have nothing else to go on to capture who the accomplices might have been. And also, I mean, I wouldn't totally put it past her to steal somebody's car in the commission of this crime, right, and do it alone.
If she could even figure out how to drive, I mean, to be really honest, like, I think of our kids that are 11 and 12 and like, Kennedy will go start my truck and you have to put your foot on the brake and push the start button. And she'll be like, is it the pedal on the left or the right? And can't barely reach them. So it's just, but I mean, I don't know. It's just insane to think.
But we have a good girl. That's the difference. We have a sweet girl, an innocent girl. Whereas this is not a typical girl. This is not a typical child. This is somebody who is sick and very twisted. And so I wouldn't put it past her to know how to drive a vehicle. I don't think that's that far-fetched. The trial took place in 1997 and lasted for about a month before Sharon was unanimously found guilty of murder. The prosecution relied heavily on her murder diaries and her knowledge of the secret details. Since she was found guilty of murder, she became Britain's youngest female murderer. The judge, Mr. Justice Baker, described her as extremely dangerous and sentenced her to life imprisonment with a minimum of 14 years. Following an appeal, this minimum tariff was later reduced to 12 years, which made her eligible for parole as early as 2009. But she has been denied every appeal since her eligibility for parole. Now, in the year after her conviction, Sharon was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and she was transferred to a high-security psychiatric facility where she continued to be a problem. She has reportedly attacked numerous prison staff and other inmates, including an attempt to strangle two nurses and a 2019 assault on a fellow prisoner. But here's something that I think we should all be concerned about. Last month, the parole board recommended that Sharon Carr be moved to an open prison. While they still refused her full release, this move could allow her more freedom and is seen as a potential path towards eventual release in approximately 2 years. However, this recommendation still has to be approved by a judge, and that decision has not been made yet.
See, I don't understand. Okay, this all happened when she was 12. So she was obviously a kid, but a horrible person. Let's just call it what it is. And now you're talking about somebody who's based on 13 and 92, 46?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 46, 47 years old. And having lots of problems in recent years. I don't understand why there's even a chance.
So I think it's probably important to note that this is essentially a transfer of facilities. She's going from a psychiatric, like, prison hospital to a normal prison is what they're recommending.
So she's but you said she's eligible for getting out, right?
Well, she is eligible for parole, but that doesn't mean she will be granted parole. She still has to go in front of a parole board and plead her case, and they have to decide. And then once the parole board makes the decision, the judge has to approve it. So there's still some hurdles she would have to go through, but it's the proximity to freedom that I think makes me and probably anyone else who is listening to this nervous, because just a little step is still a step, you know?
Yeah, I don't think she should have a chance.
I don't either. Absolutely, I don't either. And, you know, again, there has not been a decision made by a judge yet. So this could all be a moot point if a judge ultimately says, no, we're not even going to consider that. She needs to stay where she is, or she can go to another prison. You know, it might be a normal prison, but a maximum security prison instead of a state mental hospital, something to that effect. But also we have to realize that this is happening in Britain and their rules and their laws are different. Now, as of now, like you said, Sharon is approximately 46 years old. And her trial was one of the most high profile in UK history due to her age at the time of the crime and the sadistic evidence that was presented. Decades later, she remains one of the most volatile and closely monitored inmates in the British prison system. The case of Sharon Louise Carr forces us into a question that we don't typically like sitting with, which is nature versus nurture. Sharon's childhood was chaotic, violent, and unstable, but that alone does not explain what she became. Millions of children grow up surrounded by trauma and never develop a desire to torture or kill. So what makes this case so unsettling is the sense that something in Sharon was already broken. Empathy never fully formed, fear never functioned as a brake pedal for her, and violence never repelled her. It like was a sense of reward for her. So nurture may have accelerated what was already there, but in my opinion, it didn't create it. I think somebody like Sharon is born bad, just born evil.
Well, and then had a super traumatic childhood and then, I mean, made herself into this criminal as a kid. Like, yeah, I agree. That's nuts.
Yeah. While Sharon's psychology has been endlessly examined, it's important not to let that eclipse the person who matters most here, and that is Katie Ratcliffe. Katie should be remembered for not how she died, but for how she lived. She was an 18-year-old young woman with plans, with kindness, with a future she was actively building. She trusted the world because she had no reason not to. Her life was full of hope, family, friendships, work that she cared about, and dreams that should have had time to unfold. And Katie didn't lose her life because of a bad decision or a risky choice. She lost it because she crossed paths with someone who was fundamentally evil in a way that no one could have predicted. And that's the real tragedy of this case. Not just that evil can exist so young, but that goodness so often never gets the chance to grow old. And Katie Ratcliffe deserved that chance.
That's deep and true.
Well, that is it. That is the story for today. Any final thoughts, Austin?
That's crazy. And I enjoy recording with you, but I see why part of the reason I'm not into true crime.
Well, to your point, if you thought that this was a decent episode, if you liked the coverage of it, or if you just want to support this show in general, make sure you're following it on whatever platform you're choosing to listen and share it with anyone else you know who is interested in true crime or just examining the human mind.
In a little context, I'm just not that into true crime. So that's why I sounded like that. But I know people are, and I think you do a great job with your podcast, babe. And I appreciate all the people who listen.
Thank you so much. Now, with that said,
Mama, mystery.
No, not yet for that. Nope. I have started saying a new thing, Austin. It is stay curious, stay vigilant.
Mama.
Mama.
Mystery. Out.
Bye.